actually a lot more parallel than I think. And so the notion that we have capacity to do research by bridging community groups to investigators, what is much better for us is to write the competition in such a way that people who have these bridges built are going to be successful, and people who are doing research within an effective service infrastructure with some add-on features that are almost inevitably going to be required. In other words, we don't expect every dollar of our research investment to buy us a dollar of data product. We think there's going to be 10 cents of childcare and 10 cents of transportation and 10 cents. I mean, there's a realistic facilitative role that the research dollars can play. But I thought I should just put that at a front.
You brought up the point about some of it being done long-term, some of it being done cross-sectional. What we've been visualizing it so far is that there's a core that's just a butter epidemiology where you get the people in, you do the assessments on all of them for the full course of disease. Build in flexibility so you can put in special subs if you need a few cross-sections outside, and you do that with full funding. You also build in a little bit extra so that as ideas arise, as long as you keep longitudinal core, as long as you can make sure you get a certain group of women packed all the way head on all these other core, that's the way it's been visualized, and I think it works. And it'll be difficult, I think, to get everybody to really understand how a study works like this. Not everybody's used to thinking this way or working this way, working as a group on something like this. And it's going to take a lot of time to build all of the different investigators.
Just to back up a little, I think where we in my mind some of the frustration comes from in terms of us saying, well, we can't define the population is, it's not the first time I've been asked the question, and I feel very frustrated that it's just because I'm an AIDS activist doesn't mean I know where all the HIV-positive women are. You know, I think in some ways, we have some liaisons, you know, with the HIV-infected community, and some of the women are more attuned to some of the women infected, but we don't always have the strongest liaisons. We're not going to see, like, at an ACT UP meeting, representation of the HIV-infected population of women, which is too bad. It's not that the established bridges are there, although some people do have personal linkages themselves. So that's where I think some of the frustration comes from, and just to allay that. But also this, you know, it's just to state the obvious, but why not state it anyway, is obviously when you're hitting all these different populations and trying to reach out to them and get them involved, you're going to run against a lot of barriers, some psychological barriers and other things about, you know, you may be saying this is great, people should be involved, you're going to get medical care, and they're like, you know, where, you know, how are they going to trust and build a relationship, and I don't know if it's, you know, going to be locally farmed out to somebody that you'll be working with somebody who understands that, and they will be the ones who will be actually recruiting the population per se. I don't know how this is all fleshed out, but I mean, obviously there's going to be local communities that are going to have to be addressed and recruited in different ways in other communities just based on their needs. And
I think the success with what we've offered so far, they go and they get to know the people that tell you where they go and what their needs are. And I think every technique that built.
Chicago, Lane Leibel's initiative, he's been very successful in recruiting and retaining active drug users because he's recruited former drug users. And virtually his entire staff of outreach workers are people who are from the community and still in touch with people they used to shoot up with. And he's had some amazing successes in, I think, Dave Lehoff's cohort also in Baltimore. Is an active drug using population, and he has much better, Liza Solomon's the PI now of their women's study that CDC is sponsoring, to use this innovative and imaginative way of reaching out into the community and get people who have been thought of as essentially unavailable to studies, and they're showing that's not true. Judith Cohn is another good example. So I think there are good examples. I think where Diana Hartel worked, Ellie Schoenbaum's cohort, Jared Friedland, that group, Peter Selwyn, they also had considerable success because they were tied into drug treatment environments. Howard Minkoff's a good example of success because he provides caring health care for people. I mean, he actually cares about his patients, and his patients are the ones who he's recruiting into the study. I mean, that's oversimplifying it somewhat, but the notion that you have a confident working relationship with a healthcare provider can be an enormous incentive for a woman to come back to an appointment. feeling that somebody cares about her is going to care about her, her family, her needs. And we think we have a sense of where a number of investigators have done a pretty good job of recruitment and retention of women in studies. Where we're concerned is that there aren't more of those models, and that's where a lot of the discussion that we've been carrying here at the affirmative action idea, the notion of going into areas where, no, there isn't a successful model, but there could be if there were some creative thinking applied and if some bridges were built between the community groups and the investigative, the people with investigative capacity.
Can't you just make that mandatory on the application?
Well, that's right. We intend to.
Okay.
But
when?
Well, the application
because I come from Raleigh, and Duke Medical Hospital is supposed to be one of the biggest hospitals, and they don't even want to deal with me and my GYN problems, you know. And here I am, I asked this, can you give me a biopsy and find out what the hell's going on with me? He says, but what am I going to do with the data? I looked at him, I said, what? You don't know what to do with the hell with the data? I just want to know what the hell I have. And he didn't know what to do with his data. So, you know, I think that if you implement the mandatory system for them, they will have to learn HIV and women in GYN, because I'm getting run around in Raleigh, and now I've got to move to another state to get better treatment. You know, so I think if you mandate it, it'll be better for the little areas that you all are talking about, you know, San Francisco, whatever. I think everybody should be input in this. Every state, I don't care how small or how large it is, everyone should have an input in it, so like that we know where we should get help and not get help back.
I mean, maybe certain, you know, we were talking about pole dancing cities, but maybe it requires mobile research teams, you know, across the states. And I mean, seriously, and I don't mean people who don't necessarily end up being the people having the primary care relationship with the woman who becomes part of this research. I mean people literally that have a schedule of going out to a certain number of sites where they have gotten phone calls from physicians or other kinds of healthcare workers of women who would be willing to be part of this study, and that their basic job would be to travel around the states, you know, reaching those places at a particular point in time, and making sure that the examination and the interview is done, and literally picking it up. You know, if you can't trust that someone on a site, you know, a local MD can do that. But it seems to me that that's the kind of creative thinking that this necessitates. Because it's not going to happen otherwise. And if you, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think there are rural women with HIV who are never going to be in here. Okay? I know that the people in Detroit had a largely white sample. In Detroit, Michigan, I say to myself, how did they manage to do this? Yeah, people who sent in data to the Spectrum Disease Study, okay? A largely white population from Detroit. You know, you have to work hard to go to a majority black city and send in data on white people.
The woman who has the site with the CDC, Paula Schumann, does not have a white population.
Okay.
You know, one thing that we come across in Santa Barbara is that, you know, the service providers come to these meetings only when they think money is available. And that their, you know, their survival for their programs is as whole. And if they need $100,000, they don't care if 10,000 comes from 10 grants or one grant. So a lot of times the service providers are struggling to keep their own programs aboard and not advocating for the people who are actually receiving the services. In Santa Barbara, for example, you were just saying earlier, Sten, that you went and talked to a consortium, you know, and da-da-da-da-da. Well, how did consortiums get developed? Because there was this hunk of money called Ryan White funds that are still are not funded fully, but here was money. And it forced the communities to pull together, whether they like sitting at the tables or not together, and it pulled them together so that some of these organizations now start tapping into each other. But without it being a requirement, that will not happen, at least not in Santa Barbara, not in the second and third wave areas, which Santa Barbara is, and it's a resort town. And even though we're only an hour and a half away from the urban center Los Angeles, we still haven't seen an influx, except we're starting to see the second and third wave now. But I think that's true for a lot of different size areas all over the United States, let alone, you know, from my personal experience of the West Coast.
I think you're making a very good point, that the government can be a better team builder, the because of the financial hammer than we have been. In the sense, we have talked a lot about the language of the RFA trying to explicitly favor consortia arrangements and explicitly favor innovative outreach models and explicitly, now, just because we write the RFA properly doesn't necessarily mean it would happen all by itself, but it would improve the odds, that's for sure.
And, I mean, in terms of my experience working with Ryan, for all its faults, it is a very innovative example of what, you know, first of all, what a government can do in terms, a government agency can do in terms of legislating things. Also what local communities do in terms of creating through, and what there's consortia then can turn proposals to other groups for other types of funding, bring together other services that didn't exist, overlap, and a model to look at. And in some ways that is what things like community consortium in San Francisco are. I mean, it is a consortium of groups working together and pooling data. And
I think that's conspicuous for uniqueness. I mean, there are very few such research models that have done what the community consortium has done. And that I agree with you, that has accomplished a lot that would not have been possible if they hadn't bridged to so many investigators.
But it's
so
possible
many clinicians they weren't really
to create the RFA in such a way that it encourages, if not requires, the formation of such things. You know, that it's possible, I'm sure that we're all possible for an agent to direct the answers.
I think it's going to be, from what I've heard about it, all the people you've been
interested in,
if there are long-term survivors, it could certainly be identified.
There are cohorts of women that have been around. All the IQ studies
in
the
20s. But
yeah,
I mean, I was just really working to ensure that when that study does get off the ground, that it includes women in it, because it just seems really responsible.
The only motive for using MAPS is that we can do a piece of work so quickly and give a lot more guidance to the ACT-UP effort. I mean, the people I've been talking to ACT-UP would like to initiate their own study. I mean, they would like to set up an infrastructure, which is community-based infrastructure, to reach out to HIV-positive persons who meet certain criteria for survivorship. That can be immunologic survivorship, or it can be survivorship in years. There are various definitional issues that we're working out. And the point of next was to hone, I mean, when we've brainstormed, both within the program and within ACT-UP, we've each brainstormed with our own set of experts and actually come up with very amazingly parallel lists of things that are important contributors there's a 7 o'clock meeting here. And the point is, the list is too long. There are too many variables that can impact on this. We have to set priorities within the lists. Because it won't be a feasible study to look at all of the features that might be relevant. We have to say this one is not likely to be, you know, the more important issue, and these are likely to be really important, and that's why we wanted to exploit MAX, because we can do it a lot faster. If I pride myself in anything, it's attentiveness to women's issues on our research platter in the EPI branch, and you have my word that we won't initiate any new monies. This is another advantage of, these are monies that are already spent, if you will. It's almost an organizational effort within the MAX to reach into the database, pull it out, and do some assigned sub-study.
And it's not possible to do that in the IBD?
We don't sponsor those cohorts. I mean, NIDA sponsors them, but I think it would be a very legitimate question to approach those studies. For example, the study we worked with at Montefiore, even though we don't pay for it, we happen to have worked there previously. And people we work with still, and that might be a very good pool of women. They have 25, they have over 300 women in that study.
In Baltimore, so I think instead of trying to do government-to-government research, go to the investigators straight out.
Right.
But I also want to say that if in the end you end up interviewing those long-term survivors, then that's where a cross-sectional piece should be added. That is more, their physicians may have the data, you may not have, but each time that you create a study that does not seek a parallel group of women at this historical moment, you are putting back in time what you will ever learn about women. You just automatically, and you know, the first cases of women with HIV were in 1981, just like men. You know, and we're 11 years here because no one paid any attention to men. And we don't have to keep doing that. If it just becomes a matter of course that in some way you build it in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. you know, then you do it, even if it's not exactly the most
point.
Elegant.
I might part. Also suggest that within the ACT UP group, there are three people who have been especially involved, and you might want to talk with them, because, well, they've never brought this issue up, so I think it might be worthwhile to expand the group, working group. You know, in other words, Mark Harrington, Greg Gonzalez, and John Endy, all of whom have done yeoman's duty in this, and I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying that if there's no closed club to this. I mean, they approached us on the issue. We were interested in doing.
It did become closed.
You. Well, but not from our point of view.
Well,
I mean, we'd be happy to share the information we're sharing.
I just want to bring the point up to you because if there
okay,
is funding,
that's
that
useful.
Goes on,
absolutely.
Yeah.
There will. There isn't any money. We're trying to do it with existing money and some clever organization. If this pans out and there's something to the science, we absolutely should consider serious restructuring.
Can you just tell me this first step? That I should talk to my doctor and ask him to do for me? I mean, as far as they do, what is that, biopsy or a sonogram? I don't know what's the first procedure to start, you know, doing some analysis, you know, for myself.
Well, one of the most important things you need is a pap smear. I mean, we need to make absolutely sure that that if you're immunosuppressed, that papillomavirus-induced cervical disease doesn't manifest, because it's preventable cancer. I mean, there's nobody. Every case of cervical cancer is a public health failure.
There's
one study that says they're not that accurate, and there are five studies that say they're very accurate.
So what
and
are the
I
other
think
ones?
That they are probably very accurate, although we're doing studies to try
you
to
know why?
Confirm
because
that.
My age is
we're talking about repetitive pap smears. A single pap smear has a huge false negative rate. But repetitive pap smears, and I recommend every 6-month pap smears in women who have under 200 T-cells. I know that's not what CDC recommends, but that's, I think, very prudent public health policy in the immunosuppressed woman because of the rapidity of potential progression. And then a lot of the other things that might be recommended, I don't know, Howard's the OBGYN expert. I'm a retread pediatrician,
worth
talking to him about specific symptoms that you have that would be worth following up on with specific
See, I have to find out the specific. That's the whole thing. I don't know where is my specific. And the pap smear don't show. And my age is sneaky.
Well, if your pap smear is normal, that's a good sign. And that's a good thing that you need every 6-month pap smear.
Okay.
And then there are a lot of other things that they look for on the pelvic.
Wait, it's my turn.
Yeah.
Do you have any business cards you can pass around while the rest of us?
I have a question about that.
I don't know. I think so.
Who gets funded? And, you know, I always think in punitive terms because I have a 13-year-old. But what happens if people don't do what they say they were going to do on the basis for which they received the money? Do you just let it go forever and hope that they'll get it right, or is there a way that you can say like, "Oops, sorry, your check is no longer in the mail"?
It depends upon how we've written the terms of award. If we've written the terms of award in such a way that essentially says we're signing a check and wishing you well, then our ability to bring an investigator into line is not as strong. There are certain types of awards where that is the standard operating procedure. The investigator-initiated grant is very much we're buying into your ideas, into your impressing a peer review group, and
right,
into your
that's
reputation,
not what this is.
And we wish you well. Well, this is a cooperative. This is going to be a cooperative agreement for parts of it and a contract for other parts of it. And contract is a very direct control mechanism where, and the data centers are being funded on contract. They don't do the job. We can withhold funds. We can cancel
right.
the contract and initiate something else. Cooperative agreement is also depends upon how the terms of award are written. And if we write them in such a way that gives us decision points and criteria for success, we could be a lot more. And the new ACTG is written in a much more responsive way to government judgment on productivity, and has actual criteria for productivity, and is an effort by my colleagues elsewhere in the program to operationalize a more disciplined approach to accountability.
Are you going
to
do that with RFA?
Yes, we are. We are going to write this in a way that dysfunctional sites can get cut off.
Okay.
me just run this by you real quick. This is one of the major problems we have. Say we start to have access to OBGYN doctor, HIV educated. The county, you can call any AIDS project, AIDS Project Los Angeles, you can call any of them, and they will not have a referral for an OB that's HIV. Like in our support groups and stuff, we've had probably 300 women come through that since February, and 20 or 30 of us come around the women ask doctor. None of us have. So what we're kind of like just trying to educate the students right now that have been that successful. In a county the size of Los Angeles, we cannot really.
Do you know anybody in L.A., Howard, who is
we
one,
have
one
RN, Christine Chandler, and that's it.
There's one woman who's doing one of the apokinetic studies that I'm blanking on her head, Joel Sullivan. It's one woman from L.A. It is interesting
she's
you mention
PI,
this in L.A. because I know a lot of OBGYNs who are interested in AIDS, but I can't think of anybody from L.A. I mean,
because like when I go to the doctor, I mean, I had a period.
There will
the
be enormous.
Say,
yeah,
wrong.
I can tell there'll be enormous
said,
fiscal and academic incentive for people to get interested in this with our competition, and we have got interest in the LA community that has been expressed fairly substantially to generate a competitive site for this women's study, and they are going to absolutely have to have this expertise on board. So. I would hope
see,
that there would be
the
incentive
doctors,
from the research dollars for people actually to be, get more interested in the service environment.
What
as well.
They're doing is they're putting HIV positive women on birth control pills.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the cure to do it to me. It's been an act. It's been what about the women out there on birth control pills to regulate? I don't know.
I say related to, since time is running short and a lot of you have 7 o'clock meetings, I actually have one. When you call me, I'm usually not there, or I'm in a meeting or something. It's not for lack of interest that I am not receiving a call. It's because I'm physically not present. Karen Code, C-O-D-E, Diana Hartel, H-A-R-T-E-L, have exactly the same phone number and fax number. They are a little more available. I'm not saying that they're in the office much either with our lifestyles, but the point is you shouldn't necessarily ask for me. You should ask for somebody who can to help you with women's issues. And we have a tiny consortium of only 4 of us. More or less track these issues, and you'll get one of us, and if it's important for me to hear about it, I'll hear about it. If it's not important, you will avoid playing telephone tag. And I mentioned that just for your own convenience, really.
Janice
Cordell.
What's
Cook's first name?
Janice Cordell. Cordell, C-O-R-D-E-L-L, Hartel, H-A-R-T-E-L, is Diana, and Code, C-O-D-E, are 3 of the key people, and we have a new employee starting in mid-January who's a nurse epidemiologist by the name of Galbraith. So these 4 people are more or less our. Now, if you're interested in the perinatal transmission studies around pregnant women's, well, the natural history of pregnancy in HIV is very well accommodated in most studies, and that has been a conspicuous part of those studies. I mean, if anybody says
only if
we're
going to look at GP120, then call us.
Well, you know, if that were to pan out, we would hope it would be generalizable to a lot more than kids.
Stan, what do you know about in California? The health officers, county health officers meetings are having talks about keeping 2 sets of what they call books on epidemiology. 1, according to the current CDC definition, and then 2, when the new definition kicks in, starting another set, but keep running the old definition, surveillance epidemiology, in conjunction. I'm wondering, because a lot of times we see this shifting of the almighty AIDS dollars instead of additional AIDS dollars. I'm wondering if that one is an option, or are they just spewing out there, or trying to scare the shit out of us, or 2, where's the budget money come from, the state epidemiology things? Is that connecting with you all in any way? Do you get receive their data, or do you exchange information?
It's connected with the Center for Disease Control, not with NIH. NIH is your biomedical research establishment. CDC is your public health research establishment. And the city, the state departments of health have a lot of both staff and data and monetary interchange with the state health, with the CDC and the state health departments. And that's the part of the federal government that does that. I mean, it's not because NIH doesn't care about health departments. It's just that's not where the dollars are placed. And then HRSA and NIDA and other groups that do some research but do a lot of service provision also have a lot of health department links. When we deal with health departments, we often go through CDC because we can't replicate their infrastructure. They have their own paid staff nested inside the center. And I think probably since it's 7, maybe I can talk to you about anybody wants to listen, how I think they're going to run these things in parallel. Because I think I know what you're talking about. I can sort of cover that.
You have a meeting at 7.
Well, I can, because sure, 5 minutes
late,
like, we can just finish
it. The one thing that we didn't get in the stuff that was sent to us is anything from the CDC, really. Okay? And I have tried for once, but they don't like me to come here. I'm like, I can tell them how bad their research is. But their questionnaires are going to be the pilot for this study. We haven't seen them. They're the only questionnaires.
They haven't been made yet.
They're not done. That's why they're not making them.
Or drafts or anything.
Yeah. You know what I can do is tell you the topics that they've got. And I listed them, so I could do that.
Okay. And the other thing is, like, any data from inspecting the living, what is very interesting is that in the draft that they put out, which is ridiculous, they cite unpublished data for public comment. I mean, how can we comment on unpublished data?
Talked to Jim Mueller about it?
Well, I'm calling him up, and I sent them on
the
spot.
Jim had a fascinating presentation to APHA that I happened to catch. I mean, it was much better data than they had at all available at the women's meeting. That study has matured quite a lot. And given all of its limitations, I still think some of the data on women were extremely interesting. And I think if you present them at APHA, they're in the public record. I don't think it'd be difficult to contact him to get copies of selected slides and this kind of thing. You know, hard copies of selected slides. My experience with CDC is they're generally reasonably forthcoming because they know all this is in the public sector anyway. And if you submit a Freedom of Information Act request, they're going to be forced to give it to you.
Right.
So, in general, I may be naive, but I think it should be something that would be available to you. It's not published yet, but that doesn't mean that there aren't data that you could work with.
Thank you both very much.
No, well, thanks for having us. And like I said, I'm hoping this is a bit of the start of a process because we both get a lot out of it. Okay, what they're doing, just to hook to, sure. Why don't you name a relevant person who wants to work with us? We'll find you in the loop. Necessary. If we have an extra copy, we'll give it to you. Because we did make, it's just so damn expensive to make that we don't make more than we think we're going to need. And we made a few extras and then we've given away a few, so we have one extra.
That would be great. All right.
Okay.
What are you doing now? What am I doing now? The Women's Core Committee is meeting.